Thank you, Ler, but I'm going to start when I was not born and stuff like that. So I'm going to go way back in time. Just to give you a little bit of context, because people are a bit confused about it. So I was in Oxford for 20 years, and then for some 30, 40 years, I was a full professor there. We had a big group. Are you on the picture, Ler?
Yeah, that's me, Ler.
Okay, yeah. So we had a big group there. Then I left Oxford. And I first joined what was called Cambridge Quantum, which was a UK quantum software company. And then I kind of stopped being chief scientist there because Cambridge Quantum merged with part of Honeywell. It's not Honeywell who bought us. So Honeywell actually has nothing to do with it anymore. So part of Honeywell came out, and then we kind of joined and we got a new name, Quantinuum. Now I say Honeywell is our biggest investor still. So they got something to do with. Another investor is IBM, by the way, for example. So it's not that we're all competing there. So besides my overall role, I've got a team in Oxford. So this is my team in Oxford. And we mainly focus on what you see on my t-shirt here. So see, this is our logo. And this is C for compositional and I for intelligence. And you need to see this in the context of artificial intelligence. So we actually bring something new in, which is compositionality, and that's supposed to lead to interpretability, explainability, accountability, and all the words people are now throwing around. It looks like a Q2 because we're very quantum inspired, and the only unfortunate thing about it is that it also looks like a skull, which was never intended. I'm going to go back far in time to John von Neumann. So probably most of you know that John von Neumann is the father of the Hilbert space formalism, which he published in a book called The Mathematical Foundations of Quantum Mechanics in 1932. And something everybody should know, but maybe not everybody does, is that 3 years later, John von Neumann denounced his own quantum mechanical formalism. He said, this was in a letter to Gary Birkhoff, a mathematician, "I would like to make a confession which may seem immoral. I do not believe absolutely in Hilbert space no more." Then he went on to do stuff. One thing he did at the time was coming up with a field called quantum logic, together with Gary Birkhoff, who he wrote his letter with. Then he came up with Neumann algebras and stuff like that. So he actually spent a lot of his life trying to come up with alternative formalisms for quantum mechanics. In the process, he invented a bunch of new areas of mathematics, but none of them, it's fair to say, were ever considered as proper replacements of quantum mechanical formalism in terms of Hilbert space. Yeah? So now one important point I should make here is that von Neumann was a very foundational thinker, not just a very good mathematician. And he said, whenever we're going to sort of redo quantum mechanics, we should start with the conceptual foundations, pick out what's the most important thing about quantum mechanics, conceptualize that, and that should lead us to the new formalism. And for von Neumann, the most important thing was quantum measurement. So he was analyzing quantum measurement, and quantum logic was based on how logic changes when you take quantum measurement seriously and you think about propositions of a physical system. And von Neumann algebra, of course, was inspired by the non-commutativity of observables and stuff like that, and inside was a quantum logic anyway. So anyway, as most people know, quantum foundations since then was fully focused on quantum measurement, trying to interpret quantum measurement, stuff like that. All the other alternative formulations of quantum mechanics people ever proposed, they were always based on conceptualizing quantum measurement. Yeah? Okay, so this is Schrödinger. And this is a quote from Schrödinger, again from 1935. And I'm going to read this here. When two systems, so he's talking about two systems. And then he says something else. So he's talking basically what happens if you put two systems together. And he says, "I would not call that one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics." So for Schrödinger, it wasn't measurement that was so particular about quantum mechanics. It was what happens if you put two systems together, composition. Now, in practice, nobody really followed Schrödinger at the time. Everybody followed von Neumann's idea with a measurement of the focus. And I think the first people who ever sort of took the idea of composition being central for quantum seriously was myself and Samson Abramsky, a computer scientist, a famous computer scientist. So we published a paper in 2004. Which was the start of the field called categorical quantum mechanics. And there we basically try to start setting up quantum mechanics, but from the point of view of tensor being the most fundamental concept. So basically the main two operations we considered was, so we thought about, this was a theory of systems and processes. Systems were the object in a category, the processes were the morphisms, and then you could compose this process in parallel and sequentially. So you basically got a theory where composition at the forefront, and we could derive a lot of ingredients of quantum mechanics in that way. We could actually come up with a lot of quantum mechanics just using a very simple formalism. So, I mean, this is now considered as seminal. This is actually now an official area of mathematics, that there is a mathematics subject classification for this formalism now, under category theory, actually, which is kind of funny. So what we used was basically existing category theory by these people, like Jean Benabou and Max Kelly. We had to introduce something extra, which we call a dagger. So actually now dagger category is also a met subject classification. So basically the material was available. Now the important thing here is when you understand what's going on here, you feel that this is the right mathematical structure to do that, to start rebuilding quantum mechanics using composition as the prime thing. But this stuff was only invented in the early 80s, the maths. So it's obvious that nobody actually could do anything before because the maths was simply not available. So now this is Roger Penrose. He's also from Oxford. He got his Nobel Prize for black holes. Now another thing that Roger did when he was still an undergraduate study, a student at, he was in London, I think at Birkbeck. When he got his first course of general relativity, he hated the notation. He hated the notation, which is the tensor symbols you see on the left, and he kind of replaced them with pictures. He replaced them with pictures. I mean, he thought this was some sort of intuitive alternative to using tensors. And he never even published this until in the 70s in some appendix of a paper. But he started doing that. Now, here are two category theoreticians. And in the 90s, in the 90s, they showed that Penrose-style pictures were exactly the same thing as monoidal categories. So you could basically, anything you do with monoidal categories, write down in diagrammatic form. So a year later, after the 2004 paper, I published this paper, Kindergarten Quantum Mechanics. And actually, this was actually a transcript of a talk I gave here in 2005 in the big lecture theater. And you can see this is my first talk on Pearson. That was the first time I gave this talk. And the paper is pretty much a transcript from the talk I actually gave here at PI, now 18 years ago. Okay, so now the thing is, like, it was all very promising in the sense that we could do quite a bit of quantum stuff in this diagrammatic formalism, but by no means it was a substitute for the Hilbert space formalism at a time. Now, going forward in time, picturing quantum processes, I published this book with Alex Kissinger, and this is actually a full-blown course of quantum mechanics, quantum theory, I shouldn't say mechanics, quantum theory, following Lucian's distinction between these two words. You were the inventor of that distinction, right?
I don't know. I mean, I use it. I don't know if I invented it.
Oh, okay. So quantum theory is like quantum mechanics without Schrödinger equation, so to say. So quantum theory. So we do all of quantum theory. And this was an Oxford course. This was actually the quantum computing course at Oxford Computer Science. It was around like 2013, 2014, we actually had a feeling, yeah, we can basically teach all of quantum mechanics just using these pictures. Now, this book's quite a big book because something we do inside is we start with pictures and then we derive the Hilbert space formalism from the pictures so that the people taking this course also can work in the Hilbert space formalism. That's why it's so big, that book. Right? Okay, I finished that book. 5 years later, oh wait, I have to show you something. So, yeah, I brought some merch. So this is T-shirt you can buy. I can sort of publicize this here because I'm not making any money. Alex Kissinger is taking all the money for those. Anyway, so you can if you go online, if you want one, you go online, you look for Dave the Dodo T-shirt, and you can it's on Etsy or something like that. That's where you can find them. Anyway, so there was this big book. 5 years later, there's another book. With Stefano Gogioso now. So Stefano and Alex, they pretty much have taken over my group at Oxford University. They were both PhD students of mine, and they are now running the show there. So why would you write another book after you just wrote a book of 1,000 pages? So this book is quite different to the previous one in the sense that you don't need to know any maths to read it and to learn it. So it pretty much covers the same content as the big one, but aimed at a very broad audience. part of the reason of doing so was basically, I mean, that's what I have to say now. My boss tells me that I should say this is all for generating inclusivity. I mean, I believe this too, by the way. Generating inclusivity and diversity and responsibility, unlike what the people in AI are doing, that like nobody understands what they're doing and they're ruining the world and we can't interfere and the politicians don't dare to interfere. So we don't want the same thing with quantum. Now, the reason I actually wrote that book was different. I agree with what I just said, and I'll say later the reason why we actually did it initially. Anyway, so we also filmed the whole content of the book in terms of lectures. They will be publicized, and I mean, Paul and Rob here at PI, they say they want to help promoting this thing and make like nice trailers and stuff like that. So you'll probably get to hear about it. Oh, yeah, I'll give a public talk anyway when this happens here. So you'll hear about when all these things get released. So part of the reason they're not out yet is because we initially tried to publish this book ourselves as Quantinuum. You see, the publisher is Quantinuum. But it turns out to be much more complicated to publish a book than as a single book, because you need to have warehouses to store them, you need transport. So we went for Amazon Publish On Demand, which means whenever somebody wants the book, it just gets published and you get it. So we were told this is a good way, so we did it. One of the people who told us that this is a good way to do it was Terry Rudolf, because he also has a book and he's doing it that way too. The bad thing about it is you can only do this in 15 to 20 countries in the world, which we didn't know. So now we're going to go with real publisher just to get it available everywhere, because otherwise this inclusivity argument doesn't hold anymore. And once we have that in place, that's when we will do like release the videos and all of that and do some more PR around this. So that's why we're holding up. So I'm going to slowly go through what's inside. I'm doing this very quick, so this is going to be pretty quick. So the idea is that you've got a theory of wires and boxes. So the wires you have to think of as systems. I mean, you can think of them as like water hoses, electricity wires. That like water hoses is where water particles live. Electricity is where electricity particles, so to say, live. So and that's how you think about a system. It's about like, yeah, a place where the system lives. And the boxes are then things which manipulate the system. They alter them, they change them. So this can be like, I mean, you can think of the wires as some sort of a vegetable and the box as some sort of cooking process or something like that. So this pretty much applies to everything. It's very general. And if you don't know what a symmetric monoidal category is, this pretty much it is. Is it like you got the object of your category are like the wires, the boxes are like the morphisms, and what you can do then is you can plug this stuff together. You can plug them together in what you could call diagrams. And that's basically what a symmetric monoidal category is, but not in the way the mathematicians will explain it to you. They will do it in a much more complicated way, but it's really nothing else than this. Now, things become really interesting when you start to construct new things from stuff you got already available. And for example, here you see this equation, which is really nothing more than yanking a wire. That's basically the only equation we used in the kindergarten quantum mechanics paper. It looks like yanking a wire, but it's actually a non-trivial statement if you start to interpret it operationally. So you've got this bent wire and this straight wire. Now you can think of this cup at the bottom as a box. I mean, it's a box without an input, but that's not a problem. A box without an input we actually call a state. So you've got a box without an input, two wires coming out. So it's a two-system state. It's a two-system state. And actually, this represents the Bell state in the quantum mechanical formalism. Then on top, you see this cup-shaped wire. That's actually the corresponding Bell effect. So if the thing at the bottom is a bra, the thing at the top is a cat. So in a way, this language is actually a two-dimensional extension of Dirac notation. So you can embed Dirac notation very faithfully into it. And so if you now read this equation, you see I've got one particle, like you have this open wire on the left. I've got one particle coming in. Then I create a Bell state. That's the box on the bottom to the right. Then I do an operation on my first particle and one of the two Bell state particles, which is actually a Bell effect. In quantum mechanics, this corresponds to a post-selected Bell measurement, where you post-select on the Bell state. And then something comes out. So it's a non-trivial protocol, but then you say doing all of that is the same as doing nothing to your particle, because the thing on the right is the identity. Now, once you've got this cup state, you can also, for example, start sliding boxes around this cup state. And that's actually exactly the same thing as taking in linear algebra the transpose. So basically, just sliding a box around the cup is the transpose. And you see, this corresponds to a 180 degree rotation of your box. So it's very, transpose is just a rotation of your box. And here, something which also immediately follows from this is teleportation. You see, I've got like this diamond box on the left, sort of the state which Alice has and wants to get to Bob, who's on the right. And then you can basically push this box along that wire to the other side. So that's post-selected teleportation. You condition on your measurement outcome, so there's no classical communication here going on, because I'll explain this later how you do that. By the way, just to give you already, it's quite small, but like the thing you see the dodo thinking about, that's full-blown teleportation with classical telephone call and all that. And without black boxes. This is all very concrete. So that's what we, in like 10, 15 minutes, you'll understand how this works. So, but this is sort of what we're shooting for, a full-blown description of quantum teleportation without using words like, and now Alice picks up the phone and calls Bob, because that's what you usually find in textbooks. Here you don't need any words, it's all in a picture. Anyway, so this is the theory of wires, which was in my 2005 paper, and which you can find on PIRSA here as a 2005 talk. And this was not universal. I mean, at the time, nobody really believed that we could actually substitute the whole Hilbert space formalism with these pictures. But that's exactly what we did. And what you need beyond wires is something we call spiders. So what is a wire? In order to understand what a spider is, we first need to understand what a wire is. So a wire is a thing with two endpoints. Right? That's a wire, a thing with two endpoints. If you think like an extension lead, it's like a wire, and it has like two things at one side, a plug, and on the other side, a socket. Now, what happens if you got two extension leads, and you plug them together? You just get an extension lead. That's it. You just get another extension lead. We don't care about the length. We think of these things being elastic, so it's just another extension lead. Now, what is a spider? A spider is like a wire, but rather than only having two endpoints, it has multiple endpoints, or nothing if you want, or one or nothing. So it has a variable. So you can think of this like a multi-socket. A multi-socket is an example of something like this, right? The property of a multi-socket is like if you compose two multi-sockets together, so you plug the plug of one multi-socket in one of the sockets of the other, well, you again have a multi-socket. It's just a multi-socket for all practical purpose. And so this is true for the spiders too. If you fuse them together, you get again a spider. I mean, this looks like a very trivial thing. And now I don't have it in my slide, but I'm just gonna say this in words. So what is the mathematics behind the scene here? So these spiders, in the way I've defined that, with this behavior, you can find in the mathematics literature, and the technical name for them is dagger, commutative special Frobenius algebra. So now you understand why we call them spiders, right? So that's the technical description of a thing which behaves like that. Now there is also a representation theorem, which is highly non-trivial. And if you think of each of these spiders as a linear map, say think of the wires as qubits, two wires side by side would be the tensor product of two qubits, right? And if you then ask for these linear maps to obey this equation, you can actually prove that they are in one-to-one correspondence with orthonormal bases. So what you see here in front of you is an axiomatization of orthonormal bases. In quantum terms, you could say this is an axiomatization of a non-degenerate quantum observable. I mean, it doesn't look anything like that, but you'll see later how this actually comes about. So The important thing now to remember is whenever you see a spider like that, you have to think orthonormal bases. And you can have different such families of spiders simply by taking different orthonormal bases. There is a way you can actually write these spiders down and that you can represent them as orthonormal bases. I'm not going to go into that here, but because I really want to try to teach you this at face value without thinking about what's going on behind the scene in the Hilbert space formalism. I just gave you a hint that you have to think of this as an orthonormal basis, but I don't want to make this explicit. Now, the reason I say this is like, okay, here we got two spiders of two different colors. And the way you have to think about this is this, these are two different orthonormal bases. And we've got an equation here. So the way you have to think about this equation in a sort of a cartoon version is that each of these spiders sort of gives like a right uppercut to the other one, and they eat so hard that their arms fly away. Their legs fly away. It's legs, it's not arms, these spiders. So whenever you got like two wires between these spiders, they go away, they vanish. That's the way you have to think about how they relate to each other. Now, so what does this mean? I'll give again away what this means in Hilbert space. This means that these bases are mutually unbiased. So they're maximally incompatible. That's what it means. And an example would, for example, be the Z-observable and X-observable. And in the case of qubit quantum computing, if you want to use this formalism, then typically we think of the green spider as the Z basis and the red spider as the X, and of the red spider as the X basis, right? And now I've got I've got these two silly equations, green spiders of the same color fused together, spiders of different color loose two legs when they connect. And I can start doing computing now. I can actually start doing quantum circuit optimization. There's some people here actually who work on this. They work exactly on this stuff, but a little bit more sophisticated than the example I'm going to give you. So okay, here, so if you connect these spiders, and they are like I said, one is like the Z basis and one is the X basis, and you connect them like here together just with a little wire, you actually get the C-NOT gate. This is how you can build the C-NOT gate with spiders. So we got a circuit here, three qubits and three C-NOT gates. So the green thing is supposed to be the control, and then the red thing is where you either negate or not. Now let's try to simplify the circuit, because quantum computers are small and you can't just stick whatever program on a quantum computer, you try to make it as small as possible. Okay, what are we first going to do? You see there's a red spider connected to a red spider on the left, and there are three green spiders connected in the middle. So they just fuse together. So that's a simple step, they fuse together. Now it's interesting to see, this thing doesn't make any sense anymore as a quantum circuit as it is, because it's not, what is this thing, what is this thing? But it doesn't matter. Now we see two wires between green and red, so they vanish, and now we see like a spider with only two wires, with an input and output, so that's just a wire. So what I just did is I used these very simple spider equations to simplify a quantum circuit. This is, of course, a very stupid example, but this is part of the state of the art on how you optimize quantum circuits. So if you go to a compiler like the Ticket compiler of Quantinuum, this is what's happening under the hood. It uses the spiders to actually make your quantum program as short as possible.
So why do the red thing vanish?
Oh, you remember, I basically call the spider a thing, a wire with multiple edges. So if it only has two edges, it's a wire. This intuition that I told you about, like this gives you all the necessary equations.
Okay.
It gives you all the necessary equations, it gives you the representation theorem, it gives you all of that. Just the simple intuition of a generalization of a wire. Okay? Now, this for me, this is something which I'm sure a lot of people doing ZX calculus don't even know about. And I think it's one of the most beautiful things. And it's actually older than ZX calculus itself. So how do you represent classical versus quantum systems in this framework? So the way we do it is, so far I use single wires as quantum, but in fact, single wires, you're going to use only as classicals. When you see a single wire, you have to think classical. When you see a double wire, you have to think quantum. So here you see something, a spider, and it has a quantum at the bottom because there's two wires. It has classical at the top because there is one wire. So what is this? Something that goes from quantum to classical is a measurement. So this is a measurement. It's not a self-adjoint operator with blah, 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 blah. This is a measurement. You don't need anything more. Just such a simple spider. And then when you put this upside down, this is, for example, you've got a classical bit, zero, and you encode it as a quantum ket, zero. So this is encoding classical data as quantum. So here we now have a language in which we can both speak classical and quantum, and we don't extend beyond the formalism that we have. So PsiQuantum got this completely wrong in their active volume paper. I'm just saying it. Because they did it the other way around, and then they had to come up with new equations to so they got it completely wrong because they didn't speak to me enough. Anyway, so now we got these two, we got measurement, we got encoding, and now we can actually start to prove stuff about classical quantum interaction. So here is the first, this is an equation which is true because this is just two green spiders fusing together. and then you get a green spider with two wires, which is plain wire. So this basically is telling us, if I encode classical data in a certain basis, and then I measure in that basis, it's the same as doing nothing. Yeah, and this sort of trivially follows from what we already had. This is very, very simple. More interesting, so this is an equation, which we have, because we got two wires between green and red, so they vanish. This says, if I take data and I encode it in, say, the z basis, and then I measure in the x basis, and on the right-hand side, you see these two things are not at all connected anymore, so no information gets through. You lose everything. And basically, the red dot with one wire coming out is like is randomness for 0 and 1 bases, for 0 and 1 bits. So it's just, so basically, you get randomness as an output. More interesting here, so what I'm showing, these dots, you see now, they have a lot more wires. So these are non-demolition measurements. So you got a quantum system coming in, you got a quantum system coming out, and then this single wire is your classical data coming out. So what, and again, you see this equation is true because every time I see two parallel wires between different colors, I just dump them, right? So what is this expressing? This is the sort of thing where the philosophers have written 1,000 books about. This is shit telling you. So if I observe the green property of a system, let's call green size, and let's call red color or something like that. So I've got something like a car. I first look at the size. Then I look at the color, then I look at the size again, and as it turns out, what I observed first as size is completely unrelated to what I observed as size the second time, and it completely follows from our trivial equations, because again, you see the input is completely disconnected from the output. So so these sort of non-trivial properties of measurement, they are just completely trivial in this framework. Yep.
Is that a non-destructive measurement?
These are non-destructive because you retain the system. You got two wires coming in, two wires coming out. Yeah, it's non-destructive. So I mean, I know many of you have liked the new book, but so this is a paper I wrote. I mean, I call this the X calculus in two toilet settings or something like that. So this was actually a two-hour lecture which I gave in Arthur Eckert's course at Oxford, because Arthur Eckert wanted to have the X calculus in his course. He asked me to give two lectures. So if you want to understand the connection with Hilbert space formalism very quickly, then that's a good paper to actually look into. And all the stuff I showed you is in there. It's all in there. And it's really very easy to read. I mean, I teach it in an hour and a half myself. Right. Now, to go for something more sophisticated, let's go to 2022 Nobel Prize non-locality. So this is really what people call ZX calculus, these equations. So the one on the left top, I mean, you see it looks like one we saw. But the difference is we got phases, we got decorations on these spiders. So we call them phases because they actually give rise to phase gates and stuff like that. And what happens if you got like two spiders fusing together, these decorations add up. They just add up. So that's one rule. Then you got another generator, which we call the color changer. And when you take the color changer and you take a green spider, then it becomes a red spider. So it just changes the color. And then the equations on the bottom, this is what mathematicians call a bialgebra. It's a mathematical structure which is quite standard in a representation theory and fields of mathematics like that. But the way we think about it is like, I go back to my previous equation. Where is it? So here basically, what this is showing is that if I've got a two cycle, like in, you can think of this as a graph. If I've got a two cycle, you get rid of the two cycle. It just vanishes. So what about four cycles? You never can get rid of four cycles like this. So we have an equation, and the way I wrote it here at the bottom is, you see I've got a square, a four cycle, and this is a way to get rid of four cycles. And you can actually prove the two cycle equation, which I showed you before from the tree on the bottom. Now, these equations together is what's called the X calculus, essentially. This is called the X calculus, and this is, for example, enough to prove that quantum mechanics is non-local, which is what the Nobel Prize was given for last year. I'm not going to go through the calculation. You find it in the new book for kids. And basically what you see here is a GHZ scenario. Yeah, that one is the GHZ scenario. So you got like the red thing on the bottom is a GHZ state. Then the thing with angles are just rotations. And then you got a measurement. So it's a way to do different measurements on GHZ states. You got four different scenarios, because that's why four times you see a picture at the bottom with different angles. And the thing at the top is basically a parity, classical parity check. So the red dot on top is actually a classical computational operation, which is parity check. And if you compute this, which is actually quite easy, I'm not going to do it here, then you find the classical bit 1. So this is quantum scenario, and if you execute this, you get classical bit 1. So this is the expression that you got a local, what they call, and which is a horrible word, local realistic theory, which means like a local hidden variable theory. This is the expression, the six things at the bottom are actually your hidden variables, which are then sort of copied to the different measurements you do. And if you compute this, and this you can actually compute yourself now, because you see between the green and the red dots, there's always two wires, so they just vanish. And then the red thing on top is basically the zero bit. So quantum theory gives you one bit. Any possible realization as a local hidden variable theory gives you zero bit, so you get a contradiction. End of story. There's no numbers involved here in this proof, but so this is non-locality. This is actually the version of non-locality which Zeilinger himself proposes, because that's why the state here at the bottom is called G8Z with the Z for Zeilinger. Zeilinger has always been a big fan of this, by the way.
So what do you mean by this double circle here?
Oh, it means it's quantum.
Oh, so basically the bottom there represents...
Everything double is quantum. Everything double is quantum.
And then, like, the single wire means classical wire.
That's classical. That's a classical computation. That's like a classical parity check.
And if we apply the ZX rule to this green and red spider there...
So basically, if you use the ZX rule here at the bottom, you can basically commute them through each other. That's how the computation goes. I'm not going to do this explicitly because I want to say some other stuff, but you can commute them through each other.
Oh, I was asking about the connection between the green spider and the red spider. Based on this... the rule that you just described, wouldn't we just cancel out the connectivity between these two cycles? So you have the disk...
No, because it's double red.
Oh, it's not the
No, red no, so these two red dots, so this is the green dot, two wires come out to do two different red dots, not the same.
Oh.
Because they're doubled. Okay, I didn't want to go in detail because this would have taken... But but basically, if you look carefully, then you would see there is a square there downstairs, which you can get rid of. And that's how you make them commute. That's how it works.
Okay.
I mean, I gave you a book, or you had it or something like that, so you can read it there.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a review from Facebook from a 10-year-old Alexander Gicka. So, I mean, I asked his dad, can he explain to you the proof of non-locality? And his dad said, yes. I don't think it's an average 10-year-old, but still. So what we are doing now at the moment, and we're actually at the end of this experiment. It's something I've been wanting to do for 5 years. It was completely impossible to get support at university for. Now Quantinuum has been paying, and IBM is helping us to do this. So what we're doing is like we use this new book and the video lectures to teach like a bunch of secondary school students quantum mechanics in this new way. We took 8 weeks for that. We completely followed the template of a standard Oxford University postgrad course, which is 8 weeks of lectures, and then 1 hour tutorial each week or something like that. I mean, you know that, you've done that. It was very difficult because there were lots of unexpected problems because we needed ethical approval to do this with minors, and Oxford University gave us the ethical approval. But then they gave us a bunch of rules. You're not allowed to use any social media, so you're not allowed to use a discourse or something like that, where you can have some social interaction and discussion after lectures was not allowed. None of these students were allowed to talk to each other. None of these students should have information of any of the other students. So it was a very bad teaching situation where they were just isolated at home in front of a screen. And then the other thing I also didn't know about is this is Generation X. So these people don't show their face and they don't show their mouth. They type, you get a blank screen and type. So it's very different to teach people like that.
Exactly.
Very difficult to teach people like that. Anyway, we did it, it wasn't easy, and it may affect the results, but now they have three weeks to actually solve Oxford University postgrad exam questions in quantum computing. So that's, I don't know the result, and they have to hand in next week. So let's see. So that's what's going on now. So the next stage is actually to have a direct competition between Oxford University students doing Hilbert space, and so The problem, we wanted to do this, but the problem we had, now, so we would say, okay, we're going to take, for example, a course in computer science, a quantum course, or Art Records course in mathematics. The problem is all of these courses now teach diagrams. So we can't use them anymore. So but the physics, the head of physics is very keen on this, so we're going to get a group of physics students to do that for us. Okay, so this means that this stuff, I mean, I'm pretty convinced that this stuff is very important educationally and it's going to make it possible for many people who don't have the relevant background to actually get familiar with quantum and stuff like that. So that's one important aspect of it. Now, that's not just the only aspect of this new formalism. So this is a recent paper. You see and then you see the third author is quite well known, Peter Shor. We wouldn't be standing here in quantum computing if it wasn't for that person. So he's basically now also advocating ZX calculus for unifying error correction. He's the inventor of quantum error correction, and he says we need to use this now to unify error correction. Craig Gidney at Google says the same thing. James Wooten at IBM, they are both the heads of error correction at these two places, says the same thing. So this is now also becoming very widespread in quantum computing for example, error correction. Here is another paper. We were actually talking about this at lunch. You mentioned this at lunch from PsiQuantum. And we've got somebody here from Xanadu. So in all the photonic quantum computing companies that I know which don't use continuous variables so far, they're all using ZX as their main language. They're using our graphical language as their main language. Part of it is because they're doing measurement-based quantum computing, which is virtually impossible to do in Hilbert space formalism. And historically, ZX calculus came out of measurement-based quantum computing. And so what PsiQuantum is doing is fusion-based measurement-based quantum computing. And if you go to the first ZX paper, which was 3 pages, the main example was fusion-based measurement-based quantum computing. So it's not a surprise that they're particularly keen on this stuff. And I mean, if you look at that paper, it's just the only language they use is ZX calculus. So I mean, this is a very old slide, but these are the companies I'm aware of which for some reason or another use this stuff, this graphical stuff, but it's completely outdated. It's completely outdated. There's a lot more now. So why is this so powerful? So what these people proved, many of them were former PhD students of mine. So what these people proved, and it took many, many, many years, this was really, really hard, they showed that any equation you can derive using Hilbert space, linear algebra, all of that stuff, you can derive essentially, let's go back. You can derive, where is it? From these equations. This gives you as much as Hilbert space gives you, a linear algebra. But it does it, the calculations are just much simpler. That's the big difference. So in a way, I would say that this is like, this, let me go back to that slide. So this really is an alternative to Hilbert space formalism, following Schrödinger's idea that composition should be at the center stage. So this, there is no sums going on anywhere here. There's no sums, there is no vector basis explicitly, there's none of that sort of stuff going on. It's all just composing stuff using tensor product and sequential composition of maps. That's all you use. And like I said, so basically the failure of all the things von Neumann started, like quantum logic, generalized probabilistic theories, which some people know about, these were all alternative formalisms for quantum mechanics. They failed in that while conceptually they captured measurement, they could never come up with a conceptually justified description on how you compose systems in quantum mechanics. They completely failed at a composition of systems. How you represent this. On the other hand, as I showed you earlier, we have this formalism based on composition and measurement is as this very trivial representation. So you get measurement from composition, you don't get composition from measurement. That's kind of what sort of an intuition here is why this worked and the other stuff doesn't. Right. Okay, completely different story now. Completely different story. This is Jim Lambeck, who for most of his career was at McGill University in Montreal. He was a mathematician and a category theoretician. He was also a mathematical linguist. And in 1956, he published a paper called The Mathematics of Sentence Structure. So basically, what this was a bit an algebraic system, a bit of algebra, which allows you to verify whenever a sentence is grammatically well-formed. So that's what he did. I'll illustrate a little bit of this work without going into too much details. So this was Jim Lambeck. At some point in 2001, I was a postdoc with him for a year at McGill. So I think in 2005, that's interesting. I think in 2005, so I came here to give this lecture, Kindergarten Quantum Mechanics, which you find on Pearson. And then on the way back, I stopped in Montreal, and I gave the same talk there, the Kindergarten Quantum Mechanics talk in Montreal. So back in Montreal 2005, on my way back home, I gave this talk, and I was talking about quantum teleportation using diagrams, like this. The sort of thing I vaguely indicated I was doing. And then Jim was in the audience, and Jim said, "Bob, this is grammar." I said, "Wait, whoa, Jim, hey, this is quantum physics." He was quite old, you know. It's quantum physics. No, Bob, this is grammar. And he was right. So the mathematical structure of these grammatical gadgets, not the one from 56, but something he came up with in the 90s, was exactly the same as the sort of maths we were using, representing these cups and these caps and all these things. It was just exactly the same maths. But you have to look through category theory glasses. You wouldn't recognize this if you're playing with Hilbert space. You would never see this. So you need to use these diagrammatic lines. Now, I didn't take much notice because I was just starting this program of building quantum mechanics in terms of pictures, so I didn't take much notice. But then in 3 years later at Oxford, I had a few colleagues there. So there was Merun Chadrazadeh, and I actually didn't know this language stuff of Lambeck. I never bothered to actually study this, but she knew that stuff because Lambeck had asked her to develop the theory in the case of Persian, specific case of Persian, right? And she knew that. And I'll give you a little bit of an idea on how this works. So basically, the way this works is like you got grammatical types, like you got sentence, you got noun, you got transitive verb, you got adjective, lots of grammatical types. Some of these types are considered as atomic or primal, so they're undivisible, like elementary particles, think just elementary particles or something like that. And examples of that are a noun and a sentence, and the intuition is typically these are things which makes sense on their own. If I ask you a question, then you may answer a noun. I can tell a sentence to explain you something. So these things make sense in their own right. Now, something that doesn't make sense in its own right is, for example, a transitive verb, because it needs a subject and an object to actually form a well-formed whole. Now, the way you represent this is, you see on top this expression, I've got sentence, S, and then I got N minus 1 on the left and N minus 1 on the right. This means I need the noun here. The minus one means it's like asking for one. It's not having one. It's like I want one. And the name of this structure is called the pregroup. It's like a group, but it has the left and right inverses are not the same. And this is partly because of the non-commutativity of language and stuff like that. Now, if I then stick a noun on the left and the right, they cancel out. You know, I mean, just as a technical remark, you can't just say I take group without inverses because that doesn't work. With left and right inverses not the same, that doesn't work. So you basically have to sort of drop equation and replace it by partial order or something like that, and then you get like something which is called a pregroup. But you see here, when I stick a noun on the left and I stick a noun on the right, they cancel out because the other ones are inverses. And what stays is a sentence. So this says like noun, transitive verb, noun is a well-formed sentence because I get sentence. And if I would stick another word in there that doesn't belong there, I couldn't do this calculation. Now, the important thing about this is that this particular calculation you can represent by a diagram. See, it's like a little bit like particle annihilation. You see the N and then minus one N, they sort of annihilate each other. So I represent this by this cup and nothing else comes through, while the sentence type comes through. Just remember this simple picture because it's going to come back. So this, you have to think of this picture as a witness of the fact that that particular sentence is grammatically correct. It is actually a representation of the calculation. It's a representation of the process of verifying that the sentence is grammatically correct, right? Okay, so also at Oxford at the time was Steve Clark. Steve Clark is now at Quantinuum, our head of AI. Like after that, he moved to Cambridge, then he moved to DeepMind, and then he came back to work with me. So what he was working on is something you all know very well now. This is like vector embeddings of meanings. This is like if you got word meanings, then you represent them by vectors. This is what ChatGPT does. That's what all these large language models do. They represent meanings by vectors. Now, at the time that Steve was doing this, 2004, 2005, 2006, this was purely an academic discipline. There hadn't been any deep learning. This was purely an academic discipline to represent meanings by vectors. Now, so we were in the same sort of corridor and stuff like that. I mean, Steve was not in my group because he was a linguist, but we talked, and then a natural question came up, was like, how can you combine grammar and meaning? So nobody had ever done that in a way that basically allows you to put these two together. So I've got a theory of meaning, factors, I've got a theory of grammar, these sort of things which I showed you. But we as people, if I tell you a sentence which you never heard before, it's grammatically correct, and you know the word meanings, then you get the sentence meaning. You understand what I'm saying. Probably I've been saying sentences today that you never heard before, but you understand, hopefully, what I'm saying. And this is sort of what people call Frege compositionality, the fact that meanings of words, given the way they are in relationship to each other, which is the grammatical structure, give you the meaning of a whole. So the meaning of the parts, together with how they're put together, gives you the meaning of the whole. But there was no theory, no science on how you would actually do this with, say, for example, this way of giving meaning to things and this way of representing grammar. Now, when they told me that, I said, well, I know the answer. I'm arrogant. Of course, I'm arrogant. But it wasn't just arrogance. It was actually true that I knew the answer to how to do that. Because Jim had told me. So we got this new quantum formalism with these diagrams. Now, these diagrams, they're grammar. If you want to, you can embed grammar in there. That's what Jim told me. Now, what flows in the wires in quantum mechanics are vectors. That's vectors. Vectors flow in the wire. So the quantum formalism, recasted with these diagrams, gave you a solution to this problem. We had to test whether it actually worked and all that. And we did this, and it worked amazingly good. And we outperformed anybody else because nobody else really had a proper theory how to do this sort of. They were just hacking stuff together and stuff like that. So it was very easy to outperform that. So we wrote this paper, Mathematical Foundations for a Compositional Distributional Model of Meaning. This is more or less how it works. This is the algorithm. This is literally the algorithm which gives you meaning of sentences. So what you got on top? So these boxes, they are boxes like before. They're just vectors, like quantum states. Like quantum states are vectors. You have to think of these boxes as vectors, which represent the meaning of Alice, which represent the meaning of Bob, and which represent the meaning of hate. Now, an important difference with, say, ChatGPT is that in ChatGPT, all these vectors live in the same space. They live all in the same space. While here you see, for example, that hate has more wires coming out, so it lives in a different space. It lives in a composite space. That's just a side remark. What you see on the bottom was our little calculation, which represented grammatical correctness of that sentence. So what we do here, we have these vectors, and then we stick this thing, then we apply this thing. This should be thought of as a linear map, like with the cup-shaped thing, exactly like what you found in teleportation. The same representation as like the cup and the Bell states in teleportation. These are like Bell states. These are really like Bell states and stuff like that. And then, so you basically can compute this thing. You can compute this thing, and you get a vector. And that's supposed to be the meaning of the sentence. That's how it works. And then when you do that, so what people were interested in at the time, for example, was if you got a bunch of words, you want to know how similar they are. And the way you do this is you take their vectors and then you compute the inner product. And you think of the inner product as like a measure of similarity. And what we could do then is we could do similarity of sentences. Yeah?
Can you embed like tense into the structure?
Tense, you mean grammatical tense?
Yeah,
I mean, in principle, so what we use here are like these grammatical theories which have been around for 50 years, like people associate the name Chomsky with all that stuff. So that's all, as long as anything is represented in these grammatical gadgets, we can deal with it. Now, the thing is like, these vector representations, they are not the ideal representations of meaning, so they come with a lot of noise. So some subtleties are just not worth bothering about. they're just not worth bothering about. But in principle, yes. Yeah?
Can I think of this tense embedding as tracking the flow of time? So it's a little bit similar to PsiQuantum's recent paper unifying flavor of fault tolerances. You have different lattices representing your surfaceal patch, and the time is floating from the bottom to the top.
So I'm hoping I can say something about that later, but the way we as humans speak is basically one word after another. So the time is going here from right to left.
Right.
And then the other dimension is some sort of meta dimension, which has no representation about time. But the way to think about it is you can really think almost like here, Bob being teleported through Hades into the sentence. You can still sort of see this diagram. It's like a double teleportation, like you've got Alice and Bob gets teleported through resource state Alice and produces Alice being in a hatred relationship with Bob. But I can explain this better because we're actually not doing this formalism anymore today. But this is like an easy stepping stone to what I hope to can say later. Anyway, so you see this is a bracket on the side. This is like taking in a product of these two sentences to see whether the meetings are closely related. And just as a side remark, like we actually use our spiders here too, for example, to represent the relative pronoun. It's very natural to actually encode many sort of functional words like relative pronouns just using the spiders. We did a lot of experiments with that too, of course. This is experimental science, by the way. This is not just like, okay, I've got a theorem. This you do with real data to check. And one of the things when we first did this work in 2008 or something like that is I told my two co-authors, like Steve and Marius, I said, never mention the word quantum. Never mention the word quantum because if people are going to see we're doing language and we're throwing quantum in, they're going to brand us as crackpots. Because you don't put these two together in one sentence. And then the media came out and they started to call this stuff quantum linguistics and quantum linguist and quantum mechanical words and stuff like that. And I said, okay, that's the end of my career. Not really. There was this guy, Feynman, and he said somewhere in the 80s that if you got a system which is quantum mechanical and you try to simulate on a classical machine, you're going to get into trouble. Because you get an exponential blow up of your resources need to scale exponentially with whatever you're doing. And for example, in case you didn't know, we have all the theory about coffee molecule. We know everything about a coffee molecule in terms of equations. We can't simulate a coffee molecule on a computer yet. And that's a small molecule. That's where we are today. So that's what he meant. Now, what we were using in order to combine meaning and grammar, linguistic structure and meaning, was we basically were using a quantum formalism. We had tensor, we had high entanglement, we had high non-Cliffordness, which is everything that makes it incredibly hard to simulate classically. And while we had very good results for what we tried, whatever we were doing didn't scale. We couldn't scale it up because the tensor became too big. So we were in trouble. Okay, so in 2016 with Will Zhang, we took the idea seriously that maybe we should do this thing on a quantum computer. And I mean, there were no real quantum computers around yet, but we proved that for whatever typical linguistic task you would do, you would get quantum advantage, algorithmic quantum advantage, on top of being able to simply store the stuff. Okay, this was theory. And then at some point, Ilias Kahn, who was then the CEO of Cambridge Quantum, when he heard about the fact that I had been thinking about like quantum AI and stuff like that as an idea, he threw some money at me and he said, okay, now do this stuff on a quantum computer. We give you our quantum computer, just do it. And I said, oh, that's impossible. It's never going to work, not in the next 10 years. So in 2020, me being very wrong, we actually did question answering on an actual quantum computer, which means we fed some sentences into the machine, we trained it, and then we asked a question and we got the right answers, based on the information we had fed in. So this was very small scale, and then we did it bigger, and then we did not bigger, and then, so then we basically, once we had done enough stuff, we made the software that we used very nice. It's called Lambek, by the way, after Jim, with a Q at the end. We made the software really nice, and we just made it like open source available for everybody. And together with like, say, the ticket compiler or something like that, you can basically go home tonight and do quantum natural language processing yourself on, say, one of the IBM machines which are freely available. You can do this yourself. You can sort of train the machine with text. What is nice about this is you don't need to be a chemist. You don't need to be a material scientist. Everybody can do this. You don't need to be a specialist in quantum, nothing. Software does all the work for you. But it enables pretty much anybody to sort of play around with quantum computers using a domain, which is just speaking, spoken language, which most people know. The main restriction, it's English. So the sort of tools you need, which are called parsers, linguistic tools, they don't exist in pretty much any other language except Japanese, which is a big restriction. Lambek. So if you want to know exactly how to do it, you go for this paper. So you can just Google Lambek. And this tells you how you actually can do this yourself tonight. And then once we made it available, like this is a team of IBM, they start to do this too, much bigger. There's another team of IBM, which started to actually use this for language generation. And the reason I'm bringing these papers up is because these three people here, they wrote a very nice blog post, An Introduction to Quantum Natural Language Processing, which basically tells in much more detail, but still not too technical, exactly what I'm trying to say here. So it's good that they wrote the blog post, so we didn't have to do anything like that. They kind of did us a nice favor. Now language is one thing, it's fun, but there are things which are even more fun, like music. So what we did, we took Lambek, we threw out the linguistic grammar, we took out linguistic meaning, we put in musical grammar, which is a thing which you can design, we put in musical meaning, and we got a new piece of software, also open source available, so you can also use it tonight. And this is for music. So you can do two things. You can, for example, do music genre classification, or you can do music generation, stuff like that. And you can do it tonight. And so we were the first one to use it because we did the thing. So we generated some songs. And one of these songs was Bob Cigar Bus, and it became number one in the classical chart.
So. Can you play it?
No, it's bad. it's not very good, actually. But it is different. I can play something else later, something better. So inside Lambek, what's going on inside Lambek is basically you start with this thing, which you saw, this is the algorithm, and then you basically want to turn this into a quantum circuit, so you can actually stick this on a quantum computer. And you use these diagrams here. So the first thing we do is we actually create some internal structuring heights using spiders. Then we pull this down. And you see it already starts to look a little bit like a circuit, because you got Alice as a wire now, which goes down. You got Bob as a wire. So Alice and Bob are now two qubits. And then you see there is this thing which is sort of entangling them. It's like these heights kind of entangling Alice and Bob. I mean, these aren't yet quantum gates. So now we start using our ZX or spiders. So we pull out the spider, and you see now I've got two synod gates there. There's two synod gates there. My quantum computer, unfortunately, has only three qubits, so I make it a little bit smaller. I mean, this is all the stuff you can do with these diagrams. And then now I'm going to parameterize my words. I parameterize my words, and I got a full-blown quantum circuit representing the sentence. So that's what's going on. That's what's going on inside Lambek. Then there is some machine learning. I'm not going to go in details. And if I got one more minute, do you have 1 minute?
1 minute, yeah.
I've got 1 minute. I want to say what for me the coolest thing is. I think all the stuff I talked about is cool, but there's something cooler. So basically what you got here is language represented as a circuit. It's not anymore language on a line, and that refers to your time comment. Now we've got a circuit here. One of the problems of this old formalism, like this sort of stuff, is it only worked for sentences. Like grammar is only a theory which tells you how to combine words into sentences. It doesn't tell you anything about combining sentences into text. It doesn't give you any structure there. So this was a big shortcoming. We could only work with sentences, not with text. But then I was thinking, if you represent language like this, so you got this Alice and you got Bob and you entangle them, this gives you sort of an idea on how you can introduce, and I'll do it now, if I've got it in the slide. So if I've got this, I can easily add another sentence. Bob likes beer. And you see, now I've got two sentences. Bob hates Alice, Alice hates Bob, Bob likes beer, and I can go on. So this idea of having circuits allows you to compose sentences. So that was my first intuition. And implicitly, that's kind of what we were doing here already. Because we had circuits, because that's what we stuck on quantum computers. So then myself and Vince, well, I'm not going to talk about this yet. Then myself, Vincent Wang and Jono, we said, OK, let's do this properly mathematically. We're going to come up with an algorithm which takes all of English language and turns it into circuits. And we're going to see if we can do it to start with. And maybe we learned something. So this is a quick cartoon. So we use a different kind of grammar. This is more like Chomsky generative grammar. The trees on top. So it's not important. I just want to give you the gist. So here, this is a sentence equipped with grammatical structure. Some kind of grammatical structure. Some kind of linguistic structure. There's also some pronoun resolution going on. It's not important. So we took something like that, a structure like that, and then we start to deform it. We start to do things with it. It's not exactly that you know the details. This is quite a complicated algorithm. Boom. And you end up with a circuit. So if you look a little bit at that circuit, all the information that was in the initial sentence is there. You see Alice, she's sober. Bob, And she sees Bob dance clumsily. So you got next boxes for all the people here who like higher order sort of diagrams and stuff like that. These are higher order diagrams, like people are using in causality and stuff like that. All the information is here. So it seems like a faithful representation of the sentence, but it's not. It's not a faithful representation of the sentence. It's better than the sentence. Why is it better than the sentence? If you take two different languages, like here I've got English and French, then you see the things on top are different because of different word orderings. So different languages have different word ordering, different sort of conventions for punctuations and stuff like that. If you go to these circuits, they all become the same. They all become the same. So these circuits actually eliminate the differences between different languages, which is quite a remarkable thing. And what is even more remarkable, I think, is, okay, so here we got the same sentence, once as a very long sentence, once as four short sentences. Circuits are exactly the same. So all this punctuation stuff, it just vanishes. The algorithm eliminates, also relative pronouns, they're gone. You don't need them anymore in these circuits. So a lot of the stuff we have in language, like conventions about word ordering, punctuations, stuff like that, the use of relative pronouns to make clear which nouns are referring to each other, is all completely unnecessary here. So what is the philosophy behind that? What's the philosophy behind that? So we people, when we speak, we can only say one word after another. It's a physical constraint we have. It's a physical constraint we have. Now, language actually doesn't want to live on a line. It wants to be a circuit, basically. It wants to be a circuit. But we can't speak circuits. We can't speak circuits. So the only thing we can do is take a circuit and then do the complete opposite of this algorithm I was doing here and do this. That's what we do. We start with our circuits and then we go to put stuff on a line, and a lot of decisions need to be made. Where do you going to place your nouns relative to a transitive verb? That's not a choice you have to make in the circuit. There is no choice there. When we speak, and you know, for any permutation of object, subject, verb, there is some language in the world which has this permutation. Different people made different choices. To have like unambiguous meaning, you need to introduce commas and punctuation and stuff like that. So we have to introduce all that stuff, relative pronouns, just to make our language unambiguous when we put it on a line. But language on a line is a lot more complex than language do I have a slide of this? Okay, so for example, here is an example of a regular sentence, like the pound next to a king that a knight can capture. It's just a sentence explaining something geometrically on this chessboard. As a circuit, it's this. It's knight can capture pawn, and pawn is next to king. You see, it has all the information you need. It has all the information you need. But we can't say this. We have to say something like this, with this big relative pronoun in the middle. And anyway, I'll stop here. There's a lot more, of course, I can say about this. If you like this stuff, you can follow me on Twitter. And if you like to listen to some good music, then you can basically get one of my CDs on Spotify or whatever it means, or you can just get them for free here. Yeah.
Oh, weird. So just now you talk about this composition and you're trying to use this diagram to unify different languages. I wonder, for example, compare French with English. French has masculine noun and the...
So basically when I say languages become the same, it's of course at the intersection of where they actually correspond to each other. Different languages have different features which sometimes have no counterparts in other languages. And then of course, there's no sense to actually compare them. I'm saying at the intersection where you can actually say the same thing. And stuff like that. So you probably, if you want to compare German to Russian, you have to forget about all these tenses and stuff like that, and all these genders, because in Russian you don't have that.
Right. Can I ask? Yeah, so just now you talk about horizontal decomposition of a quantum circuit using the ZX framework. So basically you go from the left-hand side of your circuit and you just do time, like the time slice. I'm curious about vertical decomposition. Precisely because...
Wait, I don't understand what you're saying.
Oh, so if you go back to the previous slide, not this one, maybe previously, like I think there's a notation. Yeah, for example, like that one. No, like next slide. Yeah, so here you can see apparently that the time is maybe going from the top of the diagram to the bottom of the diagram.
Yeah, here there is a clear time order because events may happen and you may say things before. So it's again subtle because I'm not considering tenses here. A very big problem here is causality in language. It's a highly non-trivial thing because in the future you can refer to some, you can say something later which actually refers to the past. Mm-hmm. So time is very complicated here. The way we think about time is just how you say things after each other. But then you may actually have flows that want to go backward in time.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious more about this vertical decomposition of, not vertical, by vertical I mean, let's say if you have a very wide...
No, but this can be composed in both directions.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I can say, for example, and you can have commutativity, I say, okay, the sun shines. Tonight I'm going to eat steak. I mean, these are two different sentences, which and the order doesn't matter. So you would have two you would have a parallel composition of them, and you can slide them against each other. So this is too direct. It happens to be in this example that it looks as if you're only no at the bottom. You see, sober, drunk. They're parallelly composed. So it's both compositions here.
Oh,
it's so everything.
So this means that ZX calculus could be applied to perform partitioning of a wider quantum circuit to shorter quantum circuit. By short, I mean a circuit over 3 qubits instead of a circuit over n qubits.
I did this. And come on, move. I did this here. I go from 4 to 3 qubits just by some deformation.
Oh. So,
so it's very good at all that stuff.
In ZX calculus, you already have a circuit partitioning method to look at a ZX diagram and then partitioning it to find the independent subcircuit that work only with a finite number or like a small number of qubits.
Let's take this because I'm not. I think you're thinking about a very particular problem.
Yeah.
But generically, this stuff is really good at deforming stuff in whatever way you want. Whether you want to turn like a deep circuit into a wide circuit and stuff like that. That's really good at that, of course.
But what if you have a highly entangled circuit? Like,
it doesn't matter. I mean, why would this make a difference?
Because if you have a highly entangled circuit, it means...
Yeah, okay, because this is becoming very technical now.
We can have one or two more questions in the audience.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, actually, so instead of a question, I have like two comments. The first one is according to, like, in terms of the tense part, I actually have a small idea. If you
which part?
Tense of
tense.
Yeah, the tense of the sentence. Well, actually, in Chinese, we don't have the tense transformation for the verbs. So you basically add a little bit of something else to specify the tense.
Ah, okay.
So if you can like add another structure to that thing, that could represent tense.
Okay.
That's one comment. The second comment is actually. I think this is very cool. It can be basically, if you give the rules, you can kind of transform and you know, kind of liquefy everything. You can easily representing, generating, and transfer things. But as always, in the form of you give the rules, but the diagram itself doesn't give new rules. You need actually add new rules to your diagram to represent more things. I think that's
what you mean by more things.
So basically, you have like equations or the like equivalent conditions of the things you can do. So that's basically your rules or your natural laws. So this diagram.
You mean? Are you talking about? I mean, you say if I've got more grammatical features, then I need more grammatical rules.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Well, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, here the grammar. The thing is, in these circuits, the grammar is substantially simplified than our sort of grammatical rules. Many of the rules we have, they're gone here.
Yeah.
Because they make no sense anymore. Rules about commas, rules about periods, they don't exist anymore here because you don't have these things.
Yeah.
So you got less, there's one question back there.
Yeah, so I can see how the graphical notation is useful for understanding language. But I don't quite see where the quantum aspect.
There's a slide I skipped. The slide is just a stummy. So basically, so here you got language as a circuit, right? The thing is like intrinsically in the way that you represent vectors, you will get like very highly non-Clifford. It will be very dense in the space. It's highly non-Clifford. We actually looked at text and then saw how entangled are these circuits, actually. They're very entangled. So they're just basically really hard to simulate on the classical machine. And I mean, the reason I put chemistry on the right is that the way you have to think about a text is like really like an evolution unfolding. So you say once, so Alice and Bob, then Alice and Bob get entangled, then maybe Bob gets entangled. And so you just got like sort of an evolving circuit evolution. So the hardness is kind of similar to the hardness of simulating chemistry here. And that's where the quantum, I mean, this is something we should test. This goes beyond like doing worst case complexity theory, because we're working with empirical data here. It's kind of hard to prove theorems about this stuff. You basically have to test it in practice. You have to test it in practice. And that's literally what we're doing. So, I mean, I can give it away here. We're working now to hopefully within 6 months or 8 months, a first demonstration of a meaningful quantum advantage. In the sense we want to do something like this, like you have ask a question about a text, maybe the text detective, I want to know who's the murderer, ask this, and then do it on quantum hardware. The existing quantum hardware is not good enough, but we know that there's going to be a machine in 6 months, which is probably good enough. That's the advantage to building hardware yourself. So that's what we're going to try to do. And then, of course, then we have to check that you can't do it with tensor network methods. You can't do it like this, you can't do it like that. But yeah, so that's what we're working towards. But it's an empirical thing. It's an empirical thing, more than a theoretical thing. Although, of course, you can have theoretical intuitions then about the hardness. Like, I say, oh yeah, it's very non-Clifford. It's highly entangled, stuff like that. But there is no exact number there.
But do those aspects like have any counterpart on the language side? Like, can you translate aspects like, you know, superposition, entanglement to...
I mean, like, for example, an entangling gate is like a transitive verb. A one-qubit gate is like an adjective. An higher-order thing could be like an adverb. An adverb is something that modifies a verb, so it's an higher-order thing that acts on a gate. So there are so many different sort of circuit ingredients of natural translation in grammatical roles.
Okay, we have a question from the Zoom by Lee Smolin.
Say hi to Lee.
Lee, would you like to ask your question? I don't know where to look, but maybe there's a camera somewhere.
Where do we get?
There, can you hear me? No.
Sorry. Okay.
Okay.
So you should mute, but Lee shouldn't.
Yeah, I thought I was supposed to mute, which I was, but then since there was no audio coming.
Where is
Can you hear me?
Sorry,
Lee, we're having some problems with the audio.
Maybe Lucian had a question. Maybe Lucian can ask his question.
Yeah, so Lucian will ask his question now, then we'll try and sort out the audio now, if you give us a few minutes.
The question was, if you manage to prove a quantum advantage that language processing can happen on a quantum computer, might you end up showing the brain has to be processing information at a quantum level, because we're very good at language processing and deducing meaning and so on.
There's quite a few sort of things that are done here. So we represent meaning as vectors. I don't think in our brain we represent meaning as vectors. I think we have much more interesting conceptual ways to do that than representing meaning by vector is pretty brute force. It's like so almost initially they did probability distribution, but then for some reason they figured out that using the whole vector space is much more efficient. But why would meaning live in a vector space? It's pretty. So to give an example, if you got a line, that's an example of a big cat. A big cat is an example of a mammal, is an example of an animal. So these sort of hierarchies you can't encode in a vector space. Vector space really is just encoding similarity between stuff, not hierarchy. And what we do there is basically using density matrices, because you can use density matrices to encode these hierarchies. And that's already a much more interesting model of meaning than your vectors themselves. I mean, this is still quantum, by the way. But so, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's people, of course, who think that. And
trying to show that this quantum process is happening.
But then the question is, to which extent are they in that? Because these are high-level structures of reasoning. So to which extent are these low-level quantum phenomena related to this high-level, high-entangled stuff that I'm having here? I mean, this is a very interesting question. I'm very sure that one thing I'm sure of is these circuits are much closer to the way we think than language. Yep. So all this Chomsky stuff about language being hardwired in our brain, I think, is nonsense. And this stuff, animals understand this. Animals do the same. One thing that is really, really bad at this, there's something in the world which is really, really bad at it. Not animals. Guess what is really, really bad at this sort of reasoning? What? Well, you have to say something more. It completely messes up anything like that, this sort of logical reasoning.
You're going to say ChatGPT.
Yes. So even with three lines, it completely starts messing up. Which is good. Yep. So.
Should we try it again online for the least question? I think his end was fine. I don't know if IT can hear me. I think there's probably a problem with our mic, because I could hear him on my phone, but very badly because of the feedback.
If I hit
on my microphone.
Unmute, is that better? I've got a binary choice here, mute and unmute.
IT, are you there?
Yes. Okay, well, I want to, am I being heard?
I hear stuff now, too.
Yes, okay.
Sorry, we still can't hear you. It's not. I don't think it's your fault.
I'm sorry, I have to do it this way.
Run down.
Oh, well, then can I ask a question?
Yes. I was sure somebody would have a question and I would know that somebody was too.
We're already talking about quantum chemistry and Hamiltonian. I'm very curious about using ZX calculus to provide a unified framework for quantum algorithms. For example, quantum...
Okay. So, I mean, I can answer. So in the Dodo book, we deal with quantum algorithms with graphical language. So we've got a chapter on algorithms. We do a couple of algorithms there. I think we do Deutsch-Josa is quite elegant, Groover. Then there's Stefano and Alex after that had a paper on a graphical representation of in- and subgroup algorithms. So that's quite a big class. But I don't think that we're there yet.
Yeah.
We're there yet. We don't have sort of the best possible graphical description of algorithms yet, and that's why there are no algorithms in the theme book. That's the one thing which is not in the theme book, quantum algorithms, because I don't think we're entirely there yet. And my intuition is that ZX is not good enough. ZX-like stuff, that you need this ZXW stuff, which we are using for... So since we have ZXW, which is quite recent, so that's where we are doing the photonic stuff, for example. It's much better in ZXW. There you can integrate, you can differentiate, you can exponentiate, you can represent Hamiltonians, all that stuff. So that's, and I also think that for algorithms, this will be necessary to get a really, really clean description. So this extension of ZX, which allows you to do a lot more stuff. So that's my guess, and that's a project to be done.
Right.
That's a project to be done.
Maybe another question. You've done quantum theory, linguistics, music. Do you have other things that you think might be susceptible to this?
What we already have done is more cognitive representation of more cognitive process. By the way, this diagram which I'm showing here, this is taken from a paper which is like a linguistic theory of space-time. So you see all these words are very space-time-like words. So you can use this linguistic structure also to encode like... I mean, this is basically taking space-time as meaning. Because not surprisingly, a lot of our vocabulary actually refers to space, like all prepositions, behind, on top, chasing, stuff like that. So it's a very important part of language. I mean, one can speculate that language came about when we needed to take down a mammoth, like something like that, and we needed to communicate to each other. Hey, you there, hey, you here. So it was all sort of space. So we build this spatial, space-time, this linguistic theory of space-time. This extends to, we also have, for example, smell and taste and sound and the way you combine all these concepts in one whole, like we humans do. We got a compositional theory of that sort of stuff too. We got a compositional theory. But again, it's much more natural to do that stuff in circuits than in grammar.
Yeah.
Obviously. I mean, I had this slide, for example, here. This is like a, you can think of this like a screenplay of a movie, like stuff which happens in a movie, and then you can immediately associate with this the visual representation, the movie itself. They sort of functorially translate in each other in a very, they preserve structure. You got structure preservation from sort of the linguistic representation of the story, and the basically the visual representation of the story. So this maybe, so when I tell you like the cheetah is chasing the ostrich, many people, not everybody, but many people would imagine visually the cheetah chasing the ostrich. So that's something we do, and I think the circuits are sort of a bridge to that sort, this sort of connections between different different modes of representing meaning.
All right. I don't know if IT has IT told me they're on the issue. I guess we don't hear anything right now. Probably it's still not working. So he has typed his question, and I'll just read it out. So
okay.
He says, note all these aspects of time are theory B stuff that are supposed to exist.
Say again.
So the question says, note all these aspects of time are theory B stuff that are supposed to exist.
Theory B.
Yeah, theory B. I don't know what that means. Maybe it's a typo, or maybe.
Theory B. Theoretical, maybe.
Theory-based, perhaps.
Theory-based. Okay, theory-based. I mean, if this is about language, I mean, like I sort of indicated before, time in the space of meaning is a very complicated thing. So there is the order in which we tell a story. There is the order in which events unfold in nature. There is the order in which events are perceived by a particular agent. If you think, for example, about like a murder story, the time perception of the events by the murderer and by the detective is completely different, because they perceive it in completely different orders.
So you just said that theory B versus theory A. So it's theory B.
No,
theory. That's a philosophical distinction.
Wait, is this alpha or beta? Is that this? Alpha and beta. Alpha and beta.
Oh,
ah.
Sorry. Apparently, audio should be fixed now, so.
Ah, okay.
If you want to try again saying something, very sorry about this technical issue. Maybe he cannot hear me because the microphone's over there.
Yeah. Hi, Lee. Do you hear me? Ler is saying that the issue should be fixed, so probably we should be able to hear you now. Yes.
Great. Okay. So what I wanted to say is now so many things back, but I wanted to start by saying that I think what you're trying to get at is much deeper than many people are hearing you at. But I think I understand, if I'm not too brazen about that, what you're trying to do. And I think what you're trying to do involves time. And I think when I say theory A versus theory B time, I'm talking about the difference between, this is a terminology of philosophers, and it's the difference between a theory of time in which you only allow relative quantities into your language and a theory of time in which you allow absolute quantities. So you're allowed to say, yesterday it rained, without having to identify you as rest today, or tomorrow will be wonderful, and 100 years will be wonderful. That is in the theory B kind of discourse about time. You would mark as if your point of view is actually part of physics, which I believe it is. And I think that the things that you're trying to group together are a group of things that in physics we're not usually allowed to take seriously, which are starting from a description of the world in which there is a point of view.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you say. We don't, I mean, to turn this into formal content and practically implementable, I'm not entirely on top of how to exactly do this distinction. So I've actually got a couple of people specifically working on this sort of issues. I mean, somebody who probably gave a talk here a few months back, Robin Lawrence, I assume he gave a talk, right? Yeah, Robin Lawrence and Chantal. So it's very complicated to actually turn these intuitions you were saying in formal substance. But I agree exactly with what you're saying, and I understand the subtlety of the difference between these times. It's hard to get right.
But I think we have to do it, because if we stay with the old version of the world in which we're only talking about time of A versus time of B, and we're only allowed to say things that are relational.
Yeah.
We're never meant to be a description of physics, a physical description of the world that allows us to have agency.
Yes. So, I mean, like you see in this picture, you see this thing is highly relational. And in fact, that's I'm glad you said the word, because when I said ChatGPT is really bad, it's very bad at relational reasoning, incredibly bad. It doesn't have a clue. Because right. Obviously there is nothing out there, because it basically can do what's out there, and there is no such thing out there. So that's what, right. Which is very good for us, because we know that we can come up with stuff in this formalism, but ChatGPT never is going to do properly. So we're in a good place there.
Right.
I've had lots of conversations with Carlo about this specific issue, this like relational aspect of language, because of course he's also big on that, as you know.
Right, but you should take everything Carlo says and turn it around. He believes that time does not exist, and I think the right thing is to start by saying time does exist. It's in fact the only thing that exists fundamentally, and we should start by looking at the implications of that.
I mean, these gates in these circuits, they're highly non-commutative, so you have to be very respectful to time when you're dealing with them.
Yes.
All right, so I think we don't have any more time for questions right now, because it's already an hour and a half. So I think we should thank Bob again for his wonderful talk.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Lee.